Good evening. Welcome to the Michigan Writers Series. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I am the Collections Librarian for English and American Literature. This evening is Patricia Clark. I should say that the next reading has been postponed. Laura Apple, A-P-O-L, has postponed till April. She has postponed until the fall, I guess. So the only thing left for the Michigan Writers Series for this semester then is the Student Writers Night, which is, I don't know, it's in April. Patricia Clark grew up in Tacoma, Washington, later graduating from the University of Washington with a BA in economics. Her other degrees include an MFA from the University of Montana, where she studied with Richard Hugo and Madeline DeFries, and a PhD in English from the University of Houston. Patricia is the author of North of Wondering, which won the first book award from the Women in Literature Press and was published in 1999, reissued in 2003. It is now available at Michigan State University Press. Oh, Michigan State University Press has both of Patricia's books for sale. And I believe she'll probably offer to sign them after the reading. She's also the co-editor of Worlds in Our Words, an anthology of contemporary American women writers, published by Blair Press, Prentice Hall, in 1997. Her poems have appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, Poetry, Slate, Stand, and The Poets Against the War anthology from Nation Books. In 2003, she received a grant from the Arts Serve Michigan and was also awarded a residency at the Tyrone Guthrie Center in, you want to pronounce this for me?
Anna McCarrig.
Okay, Ireland. Other awards include the Mississippi Review Poetry Award, 1996, the Lucille Medwick Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America in 1990, an award from the Fine Lines Oil of Olay Contest, co-sponsored by the Poetry Society of America in 2004, and residencies at the McDowell Colony, the Virginia Center of the Arts, and the Ragdale Foundation. She teaches creative writing at Grand Valley State University, where she's professor in the Department of Writing and the University Poet in Residence. In her role at Grand Valley, Patricia coordinates the Fall Poetry Night readings, which have featured Billy Collins, Robert Haas, Naomi Shihab Nye, Rita Dove and Charles Wright, and I don't know why they're not on this list, but Jim Harrison and Galway Cannell. She is also director of Grand Valley State's Writing in Ireland program, which brings students to Trinity College, Dublin, and Queen's University of Belfast. Her book, My Father on a Bicycle, was just released Wednesday, I believe. Please welcome Patricia Clark.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. I hope, can everyone hear? It sounds like my voice is like booming out there. Yeah, Tim, don't make a joke. but that's good. Thank you, Michael. And I have to say it's a major thrill to read here at MSU, and I want to really thank the people at Michigan State University Press who have, I think, do a fabulous job. I don't know how they do it. I know they walk, breathe, and sleep books, but I just think they do a fabulous job, and they're underpaid and undersung, and they deserve elevation in the world of publishing. So my heart goes out to them and their hard work. So it's great to be here. I thought I'd start with an Irish poem because wasn't yesterday St. Patrick's Day, and I have no green on. I see no one with green on. No one. Oh, okay, Henry. Don't show off. So it's a poem appropriately titled Invocation. So it's a good spot to start, I hope. Invocation. I'm taking the drastic step of imploring the trees, the 40-foot maple first, and then the two nearby copper beeches. Russet red sketches of leaves above black branches. Next, I'll bend a knee for Lake Anamacarig and the hills beyond, pastured or wooded, and for the fields divided by hedgerows, by ditches, fields where the foxes run. One last night with a magpie fledgling trembling in its mouth. I stumbled onto a deer, frantic and caught in netting, its horns snagged, and it threw itself round in a mad circle to be uncaught. Affinity with a deer, who would think it? Yet I wanted it free, and myself too. Let us lift up despite the rain. Let us knock and have open the body's marrow, socket, heart. That really did happen to me. I went for a walk often, and there was this lake, and you could walk all the way around the lake, and I brought some binoculars. And one day I'm looking ahead of me, and there's a deer doing something really weird, and I'm thinking, it's like a mating thing, but there was only one deer. So I thought, that can't be right. And it was, you know, really kind of throwing itself around a circle. And then I got the binoculars, and I realized it was caught. And I also carry a little Boy Scout knife. And I thought, well, I had this fantasy, I'll rescue the deer. And then I thought, you know, if you get near that deer is going to kill you. So I very wisely left the deer alone, and it kind of tore free and went running off through the woods with this headdress of netting. It was very strange. So I heard Diane Wachowski read on Wednesday night in Grand Rapids. She read at Aquinas College, and it was really interesting and informative. And she talked a lot about her progress as a writer, and I would say, I hope this is accurate, Diane, kind of reaching a point where wanting to not have secrets or not be secretive or to reveal things that had been secrets in the past. And it got me thinking about what writers do. I don't know about secrets. Of course, writers have that. But I remember a teacher saying to me, writers need to have obsessions, and that you should cultivate like multiple obsessions, and that this would be really good for your writing. And I think some of my writing has taken off a bit when I've let myself go into that. Now, I'm not going to get into all of my obsessions. I'm not going to name them. You're going to have to figure that part out. But I will say that I did get really into gardening for a while, and I found, Michael mentioned to me there's a lot of flower names, and I did get really, really obsessed with the names of perennials, and I don't know what it was. They give out a lot of lists at the nursery. I even woke up in the middle of the night saying things like Eupatorium, and you know, and that's when you know you've gone off the deep end, and it's good. So I thought I'd read a kind of a gardening poem, if you're into herbs, and this is called Inflorescence, Fennel. Airy green stalk that raises a compound umbel, seeded and gold as it grows. What footing hides darkly underfoot? Underground, excuse me. I neglected it for weeks till it tipped, rain-battered, spindly, trying to grow sideways. Only then did I bring out stakes and twine. Before first frost, I'll carry out a spade from its hook in the garden shed, then dig up the striated greenish-white root. Time one fall night to prepare whole baked trout on a bed of Roma tomatoes, sliced and seeded with carrot, garlic, oil, fennel. Its skin crackles brown, a faint rainbow pentimento, and aromas rise like prayer into the trout's flesh. Imagine your length laid upon something else, a root and stem pulled from the ground, transformed by a rich, thick steam. praise to the dark caverns of magic, ovens of earth and house, blending of all things together, cuisines, alchemy, art. Some poems need fewer words of introduction, and that's good too. I realized as I was reading that I'm not attached to this, and that I think that's right, that I've got this. Is that right? You could still, but is this better too? Oh, it is, okay. Tim's going, yeah. Okay, so maybe there are some issues of gender that come up in some of my poems too. So this one is the title Male Female with a slash, male slash female. He would cut into the belly of one at the kitchen sink, mother squabbling in the background, and he'd be up to his elbows in silver, blood shining from the knife, the room smelling of sweat, boots, coffee, smoke. And though I'd been at home in bed the whole time, I could see the Puyallup River, the herons rising, cattails and red-winged blackbirds with their bottle brush shapes and streaks of color. From shore to shore, a thick fog, but rolling up and off like smoke. A reel singing as the steelhead ran with the line, the hurry, the thrash and splashing, feet stumbling along the shore to keep up, to keep the line from getting cut. Surely this was a victory for them. Father saying, it's a female. Then he's pulled out the whole orange clump to show my brothers. Yes, he's saying, we'll use the roe as our next bait. And how about Saturday, early? He holds them up in front of the window, though I was never actually there to see it. Scales smeared on the faucet, on the hump between the two sinks, his forearms all silver and orange on fire. The guts and severed head lay in a mass on paper towels. Light glinted thick through the raised orange globes. Yes, good thing this was a female. Now, you know, when you have a writer in the family, you know, you've kind of got a problem in a way, because they're not exactly reliable narrators sometimes. And I think it must be kind of annoying in a way, because you've got somebody kind of watching stuff and writing stuff down and just remembering stuff, and later they're going to write it down. That's worse, because then they're going to misremember and God knows what. So I feel kind of bad, and that when I say I was never really there, I think I was, but anyway, some of it might not be true quite. Now, do they still use the word tomboys for girls, or is that gone now? They still do. I'm afraid of that. Well, I went to a Catholic school, and I have to say, I went back a couple of times with my sisters long after we'd gone to that school. And unfortunately, many of my suspicions about them remained when I got back there. We went in one day to the school, and school was over for the day. And we thought, well, the children were all gone, and the doors were open. But we thought, well, rather than just wander around, the proper thing would be to go to the office and kind of say, can we wander around? It seems, you're shaking your head, it seems like that's the right thing to do. So we went to the office and we said, you know, we were kind of proud of ourselves, and we said, you know, we went to this school. And they're like, yeah, so? And we thought we'd stop into the office, and they said, yeah, that's probably a good idea. We're going to give you a name tag. Now, I mean, there's no one in this school. We're going to give you a name tag so we can tell who is friend and who is foe. And I thought, that's the school I remember. That is the school. That's it, black and white, you know, friend and foe. Okay, this is tomboys. A word for girls who climb trees, who shinnied up the rough bark, not caring about skinned elbows and knees, who rode too fast on bicycles down alleys rutted with gravel. They refuse to come in from the dark, to their names called in a litany of names by mothers standing almost forlorn in lighted doorways. I overheard grandmother use the word for me. Was it that year or earlier when I'd stood, summer tanned and ragged, slicking back my hair in the bathroom, imagining my face as a boy's? Steve Kirby, Jimmy Georgia, Gregory Federighi. In 1961 in Tacoma, what did I know of sexual politics? Grandmother was telling mother I was disgraceful, a renegade. She recommended dresses, knitting, less time with father, less time outdoors. And then at school, Sister Gabriel's words scalded my face. "Sit like a lady," she hissed, and I tried to, knees together, not knowing what I'd done wrong. Why were the women so angry? I've gone back more than once to the school and the playground, now predictably cramped and small. Like a refugee in a war-torn country, I escaped without a glance back, taking only what I could grip in my hands or remember. So you can see why, you know, friend or foe, I still can't get over that. They said it. This is kind of a neighborhood poem, and we had some neighbors who must have been kind of horrified when we moved in because they didn't have any children. In my family, there were like 8 children. And they must have kind of looked across the fence and thought, oh, my God, you know, how many people live there? And to their credit, really infinite credit, they were so nice to us. And I still remember their cat's name. They had a cat named Andy, a really sweet cat. And when they left town, they asked me to feed their cat, and they paid me, I think, so it was a good deal. And I was a bit of a snoop, I have to admit, and I had the key. I went through their house, and I didn't go through every drawer or anything, but I did go through the rooms, and because I'd never seen such a clean house. I mean, it was just so clean. There wasn't dust, it was just perfect. So this is really about them. They were unmarried, 2 sisters and a brother. And the title is their names, Astrid, Siggy, and Bert. Where the mophead hydrangeas lolled pink and blue between our house and theirs, where the pear tree scattered its white foam outside the first floor window of their bedridden mother, where our rabbits escaped, they did this, our hutch, and yes, did chew every green stalk rising in their vegetable patch, where Bert rescued the child wailing behind a locked door from the dark cave of the garage hung with sticky curtains of spiders, where one day an ambulance bumped the curb and white-coated attendants ran to wheel out the old woman, chrome glinting, past the improbable snowball bush, never to return. Oh, the sweet-smelling house, yeast and lemon, where they lived without clutter or dust. Oh, black and white cat named Andy, Swedish too, no doubt, with his 4 meticulous paws. If we shouted in the streets, gusty days, doing our best to loft paper and balsa kites, flying bedsheet strips for tails. If father joined us, tall as the one fir sailing our front yard, showing us how to unwind string and run into the wind. If we careened into beds of neat iris, no word of reprimand escaped their lips. 3 kind muses of the first rank who came bearing cookies on a blue plate, they cut and mowed, pruning an order to all that grew on the lattice of our lives, vanished now, names nearly lost, faces watery, erased. I'm pretty fond of using place names in my poems, and I think Michael noticed he didn't see a lot of Michigan place names, but I think there's a few. Still, I do go back to Washington State a bit, and this is just a little moment kind of in the mountains called Hiking Near Paradise. Near Paradise Pass, where the icy, solitary stream sent up vapors, I rounded a bend, and my heart thumped a beat to find him down, prone in the road, his head pillowed on one arm where he lay smoking. It was the only time I went off alone with him overnight, the firs sighing overhead as we trudged along an old logging road. His eyes opened when I got close, and he simply said, "Reach into my pocket." I never felt as shy with him as I did then, fumbling at my father's jacket, its lint-lined plaid pocket. A gray-brown, whiskered field mouse hid there, trembling and squeaking like a bedspring. When I asked, he said, "No, you can't bring it home." Two gentle natures, the mouse's and his, how I still think of them napping heart to heart a few minutes there before I came along. I released it away from the stream, the road, far from any dangers I could imagine, near a half-rotted nurse log carpeted by moss. It disappeared so fast that my hands never seemed to have cupped or held it, never reached into his pocket that long ago day, the deserted road impossible to find now, overgrown and lost. I did have a wonderful time at this place called Ragdale over near Chicago, and I wanted to read one poem from there because I had a wonderful window in this room that was a round kind of porthole window, and I couldn't help but use that somewhere in a poem. It's not distracting or anything. No, that's okay. No, that's okay. I know it will. I'm sure it will. I don't doubt it. This is called The Journey. The room I sleep in rides the waves of leaves through green air, where crows are black seagulls bobbing on a crest, here, there, and disappearing. Through the porthole window, long past midnight, sails my bed and me asleep in it, out past the cow path, the curved brick wall, up over the gardens with cosmos waiting to turn their faces to the light, past the elm and its branches that sweep the ground, up past the four-sided cupola. When I open my eyes, I want to see the lake shore and the shoreline lights, the white blur of the city to the south, the dark anonymous carpet of sky. I need the cooling influence of dark, of wide open, no screens or shutters, no glass, no house or table places to set. I want to be pulled unthinking along with the moths to the sweet-scented white campion, to the blossom center, to the whole sticky heart. I think I should read the title poem of my book, My Father on a Bicycle. I think, was it Tim saying at dinner, I can't believe it, that it's kind of an illegal move at a reading if the writer has a book and doesn't read the title poem. It's sort of like, I don't know, I never heard that rule. No, it could be. And maybe you wonder what that title means, My Father on a Bicycle. And, you know, where do writers get the ideas for their poems? I think I was at the park one day and saw people. You know, there are always people out with a vengeance, exercising and doing things. This is kind of a fairly recent thing in a lot of ways. People used to just live, and they weren't on this mission to like be fit. And I guess it's good, but I think it has its downside. And I was thinking about my father, and I was thinking I never saw him like working out, you know, doing. So anyway, my father on a bicycle. If you ever saw my father in shorts, you wouldn't forget his stick thin legs, the knees knobby as windfall dwarf apples. And the only time I saw him ride a bike, Oak Street, I think, he pedaled no hands down the street to show me the stance. He wasn't a runner either, though he'd move at a quick trot when trouble came to our door, usually when the twins caught somebody's wrath. Once they set an oat grass field on fire, and trucks came red and furious down the boulevard. Another time, after a morning of water-fat balloons lobbed at cars, the cops shadowed our porch. Our father was an ambler, a stroller, a tall stander. I can see him, hair and alert, bareheaded, the waters of the Satsup or the Nooksack, the cold Chehalis, up past his knees, casting a line among boulders, deadwood, and drop-offs. Deep moving water, his abiding friend. Now, I said something about where writers get their ideas, and gosh, I'm going to reference Diane again. She said she likes a room that has a window, and I've heard that's not good advice for a writer, because you're going to look out that window and you're going to dream away the day. But I, too, like a room with a window, and I think you see things out there, and then you, or imagine things out there, and then you go out there, I hope, and look around at things. And this poem is kind of about a toad tragedy in our yard that, you know, you shouldn't try and help things, and or maybe you should, but I tried to help this toad, and then I came back and I saw that it was in trouble with another creature. So the title of this is Out with the Monarch, the Vole. And it's not like out damn spot, but you know, I'm out with the monarch, the vole, and the toad. To live as they do, vulnerably in the air, the wing assaulting wind, to breathe the wind, the cool September air, and watch the sweet autumn clematis twine and climb. To live with the scuff and smatter of leaves at the burrow hole, the dying fall of the pink geranium petal, the tomato stalk blackening from last night's chill. To live with the thought, the weight, the dead branch pitching down to shatter in the yard, the hawk's shadow, the days ahead without sun. A full moon spills its cream over Dean Lake, and boys at midnight putter on their scow. An exhalation from the lake rises to surround them, safe with a light, though far from shore. To live with water's depth and dark, some force that wants to pull things in and down. To live hidden, hurrying, hurt. The toad finds the upturned pot and crouches there, but the snake crawls across the flagstone's warmth and surprises it. To live the death, the thrash in red, the awful struggle to let breath go. To hunker down and yet be lifted up, skin tingling, synapses firing, the heart a beat, a wash, eyes wide, nose lifted to what is perceptibly near. I've been, I think Michael mentioned I had this grant from ArtServe Michigan, and I had said I would use some historical sources and write poems about the Grand River. I don't know that anyone's written poems about the Grand River before. Oh, I suppose they have. I'm sure, Diane, I think it's in poems. But I have walked along the river a lot and thought about the river, and So it features as a landscape, and I think definitely a Michigan landscape. It may not be a fast-moving river like some of the western rivers, but it's moving. It's heading out to the lake. And one year, not too long ago, I mean, there are always people who are getting lost in the river because they step into a hole, fishermen or... and one of my fears, if you've got a dog and you go out early in the morning and you walk, I mean, they're always saying on the news, and the body was discovered by somebody walking with a dog. And I think, oh, my God, someday that's going to happen to me. I'm going to be down by the river, and there's going to be a hand that comes up out of the river, and I'm going to really regret being here. So this poor man was missing. It tells you what writers, they're so weird, such weird creatures, but... This is called missing, and I was fretting about this man who, whose body they hadn't located. Missing. How can I go down to the river, nudge the car into my usual spot, and walk? How can I set the brake and clip the leash onto the dog's collar? While he's lost, how can I go stepping along the riverbank? The path curves near the lagoon, and I go with it. I count the mallards, always in pairs, most domestic of the ducks. He's lost somewhere in the river, boat found, shoes and creel found, but he himself lost between Rockford and the Blue Bridge at Fulton Street. How can I go easy? While he's lost, it doesn't seem right to walk without aim, to study swollen buds on the willows and oaks, to long for the ground softening, for the spears of green to come. How can I go easy down to the river water where I dipped my hand after my father died, river that I asked to soothe him, and now the river that has taken this life? Rivers are where my brothers stand in their tall hip boots, lines swishing out like the lithe tongues of frogs to nab a tasty bug. Rivers where my father stood, seeking quiet away from home. One day, a red helicopter clattered along overhead, low and looking, and it wasn't a time to wave. They went searching along the riverbank. It wasn't my brother they looked for, but it might have been. How can I go down to the river tomorrow, today, drive down and steer the car into a spot, knowing that he's lost in water cold as slate, soul seeking for a way to climb out. I don't know if you played this game. I don't know if I've asked people. There was a game we played called Rock School. Does that ring any bells with? No? No? Oh, well. Could be a Northwest kind of thing, but... I think it will be kind of clear in here. And I like the name. Maybe it's like the School of Hard Knocks, but with rocks in it. And there's an epigraph. We are the birds of the same branch. Rock School. How many evenings, the gray shawl of dusk wrapping the two-story house, the sisters lined up on the porch, and one pacing in front, a lecture underway, parental, imitative. I'm going downtown to smoke my pipe. This a game repeated, played until the words entered bloodstream and cells stayed like syllables of prayer. And if you let the wicked witch in, hear a cold spurt of fear, shiver of half delight, because we knew this witch, igneous rock combination blown out of the dark. The first grade nun, brittle as bone, and mother on a bad, bad day. The time we knocked a whole shelf of seedlings down, smash, dirt and green, all mixed behind the dryer. I'll spank you with my old rubber shoe. Hear the hand coming down, hairbrush, spatula, anything stiff enough to hurt, vacuum cleaner attachment, and she screams at father, "You get out too, go. Go, leave me alone." The trick was to pick a name she didn't know, a word or fruit she couldn't guess, or else the witch transformed us by her spell. A girl reads every night, pages turning like days or leaves on a tree, looking for huckleberry, quince, salmonberry, rose hips, blue rounds of deadly nightshade, mother to daughter, the fallen shelf, the word made magic, the wicked witch casting a spell to trap one forever, a turn of phrase, motion of hand, the sister in front of us turning on her heel, becoming mother in front of a mirror, or her face looking out from a photo, a voice soft, then harsh, then deeply soft, and calling my name. Just a little one. There's the river, and there's leaving the river. In the air, a taste of what we're in for. Wet damp, sharp smudge of leaf rot, sniff of iron cold, something implacable, black. Where they've stood, knee-deep in the river, in the lagoon, and also at two bends in the river, the herons are only ghosts now, heaving upward, the wingspan wide as they were tall, stick legs dangling at first, as though they were swimming in air, and then a plumb line south. The wind skids and ricochets off the water, shears inland where we walk, veering us. This year it comes. There are no happy endings. I'm going to just skip around here a little bit. Well, I wanted to read one that was from my grant, where I used some material about Grand Rapids and its history. The Public Museum in Grand Rapids has a wonderful store of photos, not really organized photos, but photos. And I went and looked at them and tried to see if I could get inspired from some of them to write poems. And it's true that some of them, usually I took photos of the photos, and then I would put the photos on my computer and look at them over a period of time and see what kind of spoke to me. And gosh, they sure did cut down an awful lot of trees around here. They cut down everything they could see. And there are photo after photo in the, there's kind of a logging file, and there are mountains of trees. I mean, trees cut for, and then people like on top of them. They're real happy to have their picture taken on top of these big, big mounds of trees. And then I think they burned the stumps. They wanted to get these trees out of the way. So that's a good impulse, I guess. Ironic that Grand Rapids becomes a furniture place then, and now they want wood, and the trees, of course, oh well, now they're going to have to get wood from somewhere else. So this is a poem called Grove that uses a little bit of the history and I hope in a way that's lyrical. Grove. Growing alongside each other at the low place that often floods, the vulnerable spot where water from the lagoon slips out to meet the river. Trees grip the trapezoid of ground with river water moving past sinuously to fill the pond. Between the curve of bank and the road, they stand grouped and also solitary, a gray spindly lot with deeply furrowed bark, two dozen or so of the fast-growing cottonwoods. If the stories are true of people being tied to trees along rivers in another country, people who were sick in their minds, would the sounds here be enough to soothe anyone ill? Or would they need more rapidly falling water, gallons that pour from pools thick with the shadows of pike, or water chunked and grinding with ice? When river sounds wash over me like the sounds of leaves, that blue-green deciduous murmur, I could lie down here on a blanket dappled by clouds, reverting to childhood or dream of last fall, ankle deep in leaves, when I envisioned a dress knitted together from the delta shapes of cottonwood leaves. Wearing it, I'd be the trunk of a swaying thing, half tree, half woman, leaf color changing day to day, mood to mood, river stories of the past soaking into me as the moisture wicks up into the cottonwoods. How the hardwoods were felled here, branded, floated down to mills, or set afire for potash, and riverboats churned the waters with people singing on a summer day. One couple clambering ashore to sit, then sleep against a tree trunk. Old photographs show the so-called river rat men in vests, in hats, balancing on rafts of logs, or next to literal mountains of trees in piles, horses, sleds, and men dwarfed and looking straight ahead, proud somehow that they could destroy so much. By 1900, all the trees were gone. The slate water takes on a gravestone gray, rushing toward the dam. Nearby, if you listen with care, near dusk, you'll hear alone the kingfisher's rattling cry before it plunges 20 feet straight down, the water parting clean as bone. A little short one. No river. Spiders. Sitting outside and seeing a spider. A little lunch moment outside. Spider among the clementines. A pale rust-colored spider crept along the tray as I was lunching outside on sunflower seeds and two sweet clementines I peeled. And it seemed as though its rusty hues were part dirt and part sunshine of the late August day, ripening to fall, the air already cooling. It was through a sudden love for the hapless spider, small as a breadcrumb, facing winter all unaware, that I warmed back to him, napping inside, after our words about chores, yard work. Now the day's labors were gone. Some cubes of chicken lay marinating in a bowl for supper. Left to do, figure out a way to behold each other in the proper light, fall's light, the light of a day coming apart under the white oaks. And I wanted to go back to a poem that I wrote about the river, using a form that maybe some of you know. It's spelled G-H-A-Z-A-L, but it's really pronounced guzzle, which is kind of a funny word for a form. But you might know it. It's a couplet form. And the word willows is repeated here a bit. It's called Riverside Guzzle. Most watery of all the trees, these willows stand in water. Ice pools around the ankles of willows. A tree's name should reveal its nature. Salix babylonica, the first word, is for willow. Doesn't it sound stretchy and pliable? Babylonica is for the weeping part of willow, from a quotation in Psalms, "By the rivers of Babylon we wept." The people hung harps on willows. The weight gave them a bent, permanent shape. A girl flings her hair down, a young willow, a golden color, like a shout, all the length of the fronds. They light up the willow. Nearby, on the concrete ramp, an ice-filled boat waits for the sun to unmoor it, sail it past the willows. In the season of thaw, this ice giving way. By the rivers of America, we wept these willows. I also wanted to read a couple newer poems, and then I'm going to go back to a poem or two in the book. A writer is always happy when they publish a book, but then they have more work that they hope to publish in the future. And I keep thinking that the snow here will end. I'm not really sure when. I've got some poems, lots of poems with snow in them, so I take that to be the landscape of Michigan. Endless snow. I've heard that just south of here, there's green and it's warm and it's nice. What have we done wrong? Something. What can I say about this? Those obsessions again, I mentioned gardening, and I think another one is food and cooking. And I think when you reach a certain point and the obsessions give you a lot of vocabulary and images, nothing really is what it is. Everything kind of takes on metaphoric significance. And if you can just be patient as a writer, you'll hopefully find out what something that you write means. So this is really kind of about soup, but you'll see. It's called Two Deaths. After the water boiled, the flesh slipped off the bones, the way a glove slides from the fingers, as though the meat had long wished to leave the skeleton's tree. In the water that roiled with onion, celery, and salt, the flesh and bones yielded up their savor into the mix. Water became, in time, a rich broth. It wasn't pretty. A scum of fat floated free with golden greenish globules. When I fished out the bones with a wide-slotted spoon, I found the bird's windpipe with its hoop tent of cartilage, the white opaque knuckles of leg socket, the breastbone's arch. You have to be willing to go through the steamed, messy kitchen, the pot splashing the stove, the red, flushed face. I wanted to admire each stage of its coming apart, each morsel that let go, how some bits hidden forever now came free. When the new sharp knife slipped, slicing my thumb, I blamed the thick, stringy chunks, the fat, thinking I was merely making soup, a January ritual after a great feast, my red drops adding a seasoning, my heart sore, at the same time sensing I was being pulled up and out of myself, glimpsing now our house from a treetop height, the oak stripped bare, the white frozen yard pocked with the prints of the dog and us, and the footprint seemed adrift in ash, snowflakes like ash filling each heel and sole. So much falling, sifting, so much separating, ligament from bone, flesh from bone, heart, tendon, beak, wingtip, knuckle, and nail, drifted, drifting, tasted, gone. Ways to measure. I would like someday to be free. The nuthatch defies gravity, inching up the oak. Two sparrows flirt in the grass over a straw. The lilacs fade, but leave an altar scent. Three ways to measure my life looking out through northern panes, the dandelion globe wisping apart, brown earth heaped up by a mole, the red-tailed hawk circling like a minute hand, sweep, sweep. Then, of course, there's the dogwood, barely leafing out, its branches raised at odd angles that snow broke off or a squirrel gnawed. Wind blowing through and past, with bark aging like a familiar face. At least what the hawk does leaves only a forum of gray-tipped feathers, something even the dog ignores, shaking her whiskered head. My mother claimed the dogwood as her favorite, especially the pink one. Stamens, gold, and cross-shaped creamy bloom swaying over the pollen-dusted woods, adrift in scent. In one breath, all gone in wind. It's a day where I live. The watcher taking precisely wounded, worded notes and the wounded heart. And this is the poplar adrift. There's an epigraph from Michigan poet Theodore Retke. I live between the heron and the wren. The poplar adrift. Not so bad, after all, to lie down in water, drifting off from the others, with no chance of coming back. At least today, the river runs green, the silt having cleared, and wherever the mallard floats, so go I. Back along the path, there's one I call the harp tree, not to be found in a field guide, having gotten its name from a pruning job with a chainsaw by two old guys who puttered up one day in a battered orange truck. Its talent is to sound now all the grief that passes it, a divining rod of sorts for that below-radar tune that's lodged in muscle and bone of those who go strolling by. The hurt that can't be shared, it shares without a word. Not so bad, after all, to be fatally on the move, facing the dam downstream. The mad used to be tied to trees along rivers in hopes the water could cure them. The sound here, their voices melding with silvery leaves, making the sharp air. And just two more. I wanted to read one called Toward Home, and then one last one from this book. This is Toward Home. In the sky above the grocery store parking lot, white throats in a dark flock, wheeling, disappearing. Sunday, the afternoon waning in color, mood, and tone, people scattering, going home. Windows down, I'm heading home along a road that dips, rises, passes empty lot, house, fallow field, then an orchard devoid of color, except for grass along a ditch no one's minded to cut. Note it all before it disappears, I tell myself, sniffing the fall air. Something lingers in this fall in the air, refusing to dissipate. What color that arrives stays, then disappears. Isaiah says, surely the people are grass, so the color green is both promise and fate. I'm dreaming back to air turning violet over that parking lot, birds winging home to an orchard roost. It's going to be on my mind for days how when someone loved is gone, the mind tries and fails to hold him. Images, faces disappear. What stays the most is voice, the musical home of our simplest words. For grief, no color at all, but dark and clear, sorrow murmured on the air. And I wanted to close with a poem that's just in, I guess it's in five parts, but it's not real long. And again, I suppose river inspired. To the extent, you know, I guess I'm not a mystic. I know I'm not, but maybe I am, because I've gone along the river and at times have had something gives me some lines or something, and I don't know if it's the river, it's the air, something. So you have to take those things, and that's again what writers do, odd people that they are. So this is called the River Motet. The imp of the divine lives along the river, democratic, among the tumbled chunks of concrete, trees broken in half by last year's storm, the asphalt path made smooth so the blind can walk here, and veterans from the home nearby. Why do you linger? To watch the lovers bend to kiss, to see how wind frets the water, to idle away an hour or two. Any town with a river is a good one, said a solid man I knew, one who understood water, its rifts, mysteries, and its soul, knew how the trout find still pools to lie in, close together, their tails languid, in a side-to-side motion, keeping their heads always pointed upriver. Wisdom is moving water. A summer downtown evening, stepping outside late, the city long since emptied. A traffic light blinks, turns red. You might be caught off guard each time. The ocalee of the red-winged blackbird sounds a second or third time before you turn your head. Musical, more punctual than the moonrise, it devotes itself to making a life along the water, nesting in brush and rock near a blue bridge and still singing. First light or winter light at midnight when only streetlight glow burns on, or in snow light, which is like the light within fog. And in all this long time, the river moves, sinuous, refusing to be slowed at all, its face reflecting sky and wind, now slate or blue-gray-green, then charcoal and silver, finally cast iron dark. If you would, let the path take you down to water, to the moving force, alive, that keeps speaking. Sometimes a whisper only, sometimes rushing, turbulent, and a few times nearly silenced by the heavy dark of winter, though never for long, and even then, moving deep under ice, this living thing, go down there, bend your knee. Thank you. I don't think they're free.
Yes, we are. I thought you might want to take questions.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I was going to offer. Or do you want to stretch your legs? Stand up, move around. Really, no question is too, I might not be able to answer it, but, you know. Yeah.
I was interested in writing habits.
Yeah.
See you go down the river in the forest. I wonder if you have a similar habit.
Well, a walking habit, yeah. I mean, I have to have a dog. I mean, it's essential. I don't know what it is. The dog is the muse. I don't know what else Mary Oliver has said. I guess I have a couple of, I mean, only little rules, I guess. And I just can't stand to have music on when I go. I mean, why would someone take music on a walk? I just don't, I'm so retro, I guess, that I just don't get that, because there's so much music around us, I can't imagine not wanting to hear that, even in the winter. But I don't like to write anything down, and I don't like to take any. I do have a pen somewhere, I think, usually with me, and a piece of scrap paper, but I figure if I think of something, it's got to be rememberable when I get home, or I'm not gonna. So I don't bring a tape recorder or anything. Does she? Is Mary Oliver?
My memory is that she tends to write down just the ideas that are necessarily related.
Yeah.
At some point.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, and you know, that said, there's no right or wrong way to do it. If it works for her, hey, she's got so many, many, many books and wonderful poems, but I think there's something about walking and kind of a rhythmic state you get into. And I guess I shouldn't have said I wasn't a mystic, because I think I am enough that I think poetry is an unconscious kind of force, and you got to tap into that. And how do you get to it? Because there's so much crap around and noise that you have to find what works for you that will get quiet. So that's what does it for me. Maybe someone else would put a headset on and they'd get to theirs. Does that answer your question? Uh-huh, Anita?
Patricia, I'm wondering about the grant that you got and the poems that you wrote on the Grand River. Mm-hmm. Did you finish that suite of poems, or
mm-hmm.
what's going to happen to that? Where will that be, a whole book?
Some of them are in this book, and some of them aren't. I guess they didn't all exactly fit in the right, you know, how it is. You put a book together and you want different. Maybe they were too much of a, you know, so they're not all in here. And there's some more that would be in the next. And it would be interesting to put some of them together in a single place. I could do a chat book, and I've thought about that. Is that what you mean?
Well, I just wondered how you saw that series and whether or not
Yeah, no, I guess I didn't really see them as a sequence too much. I mean, I figure they hang together in a certain way, and I think they'd be interesting together. But in this, they're kind of sprinkled. And then there's some others. Stan, my husband, has taken some photographs that go with some of the poems. And it could be a dream of ours at some point that maybe we could do a small book and put black and white photos and poems, and that might be nice. But they're quite meditative. I think they would look nice together, though. I mean, thanks for the question. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm done with them. There might be a few more. And then maybe they'll do something more in terms of an arc. But they're not a narrative, no. They're just little spots, bright spots, dark spots. Other things?
Uh-huh. About your time in Ireland, your residency in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
The Irish treat, at least officially, the treat poets much differently than American street poets.
Oh, yeah, they're... Well, I think if you live there, you don't pay tax or something if you're... So, no, I didn't get that, no. But, yeah, they... I do remember staying at a hotel, and why would I have told them I was a writer? But they were like impressed. And here, if you told someone at a hotel you're a writer, they'd like, so, you know, I mean, they would not be particularly, but no, they were really nice. And the Irish seem should I try it? Try it in Vancouver. The Irish are there. I was telling someone the other day, you know, when you get together with a group of people, like at this residency, often in the evenings, people would get together and share their work, or they would talk. And it seems to me that far more than here, everybody comes ready with something to perform. And they either have a poem they know by heart, or a song they can sing, or a duet. And they just get up and they do these things. It's your party piece. And I keep thinking, oh, why don't we do that? I love that. And people would sing these heartbreaking, you know, Irish ballads, and it was just really cool. So I think they do have a bit more reverence than we do for the written word and for the arts. I mean, I don't want to idealize the Irish and say they're perfect and we're just not, but because, you know, you're all here listening to poems, and that's really cool, and you'd probably like to get up and recite something, so we'll do that in the hall. What? Oh, yeah. Is MSU playing tonight? Oh, well, you've got just the perfect amount of time. That's great. Are they going to win?
No?
Maybe. Who are they play? Oh. Well, I'll root for MSU. Well, I should have said a heartier thank you, really, to all of you for coming, and to, again, to MSU for publishing my book, for being here as supporters and selling the books, and I'm just immensely grateful, and I love MSU. Go Spartans. So let's go home and watch basketball, and thank you again.